Okay, I'm going to call to order this April 28th, 2016 meeting of our task force, our joint interim task force on reentry, employment, and housing. I'm the task force chair, Michael Dembro, and I want to, we have a very interesting agenda ahead of us, but we have a lot of new faces here, including one that it may not be a new face, but it's a beautiful and long, long for face, Senator Winters.
What,
it's great to
bill
have you
do
back.
You want?
Yeah, it's
Hello.
Yes.
Hello, Task Force on Reentry.
Hi, this is Julie Harris.
Oh,
great, Julie.
Thanks for joining us.
Okay, super.
Hey, I'm going to put you guys on mute.
Okay, welcome. Okay, well, why don't we go around? For those of you who are new, I represent Northeast and Southeast Portland in the Oregon Senate, and I chair the committee on the Senate Committee on the Workforce. And my partner in crime and co-generator of this task force, Senator Winters.
And I represent South and West Salem, Monmouth, Independence, Almsville, and Turner. And in addition to task force, which I helped sponsor the bill to get this one created, I do Ways and Means. I'm the sub-co-chair of Joint Ways and Means, and my subcommittee chair involvement is Public Safety and Human Services, you know, two of the largest pieces. You combine them, and they have the largest quantity of the budget. I'm also on Emergency Board, and you probably noticed yesterday I was appointed on the Joint Committee on Transportation, which will be looking at the transportation package, as well as the governor's vision for 20 years for transportation. So even though I've been out, and it's good to get to return to this chamber, I'm looking forward to the work that we're going to get done on this committee. And I think I'm also on 3494 with Mike Schmidt and others. And we dovetail nicely with the work that's being done on that particular work group.
And let me say, generally, when people are out for a medical issue, when they come back, they get a lighter load. But in Senator Winter's case, and it must say something about her relationship with the Senate president, but looks like she's going to be pretty busy. Thank you. Okay, why don't we go around? Jim?
Hi, everybody. I'm Jim Booker from Oregon Employment Department. I'm the federal programs manager, so we manage programs that target folks who have barriers to employment.
My name is Nick Krafts. I'm the deputy director at Sponsors in Eugene.
Mike Schmidt. I'm the executive director of the Criminal Justice Commission.
Jeremy Nichols. I'm our housing case manager and housing program manager at Mercy Corps Northwest.
And I'm Trules Neal, the deputy director for Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, and I'm also representing the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors.
Janet Carlson, Marion County Commissioner, and I'm also representing Association of Oregon Counties.
I'm Eddie Alch, I'm the Vice President of Academic Affairs at Treasure Valley Community College, and I guess I represent all the community colleges.
Yeah. I'm Zoe Larmer, and I am the task force staff.
And then, speaking of staff, Sam, introduce yourself.
Sam, the Wing Me staff.
Okay, great. Why don't we go around and those who are in attendance, introduce yourself, please.
I'm Ken Thompson. I work for the I'm located at Oregon State Penitentiary in the States. And I oversee the area where about 500 of our adults in custody
My name is Josh Cook. I'm the Deputy Administrator for Oregon Corrections Enterprises.
Ken Jeske, the Administrator for Oregon Corrections Enterprises.
Cindy Booth, Administrator for Reentry and Release Department of Corrections. Marie Garcia, Legislative Manager for Department of Corrections.
Brianna Edwards, Master Student at OSU.
Andrea Fogg, Legislative and Public Affairs Manager for the Oregon Employment Department.
Commissioner Yard, Oregon County. Serena Stoudemire Wesley, Director of Equity and Community Engagement for the Governor's Office.
All right, welcome all of you. I'm glad that we're back meeting and that we chose today to meet because, as many of you know, this is reentry week, the work that we're engaged in being recognized and celebrated all over the country. And it really is important work. And I'm looking forward to everything we're going to learn today. You may remember, task force members, that we've decided to kind of segment our work. So we're loading ourselves up with information early on the sort of the first phase of the incarceration experience. How do things work in terms of preparing inmates for release while they are incarcerated? How are they being prepared for success on the outside world? And also, what barriers are there? Where could we be improving? And what would it take to get those improvements? That's our job. That's a part of the job of this task force. We will then move in, our next meeting, I think we're going to start moving more into the transition phase of the process. And I will say, next time, I'd like us to start talking about potential legislative concepts. I don't think it's too early to start doing that. There were some things that were talked about during the 2016 session that didn't move forward, and I'd like to hear more about them and have us give input on them. And so, please, based on what you hear today or what you know already, keep your thinking caps on in terms of, where could the legislature play a role, both in outright statutory authority, in terms of funding, in terms of using the bully pulpit with our partners in various agencies and other sectors of government and private industry. So, we're going to start off with a presentation on short-term transition and alternative incarceration plans. Before we do that, is there anything that, related to the issues that we're dealing with, any kind of news items that any of you know, anything that has happened in the last month in this world that the rest of us should know about? Jeremy?
Yeah, I mean, HUD, I'm sure a lot of you saw this, but HUD released a statement basically saying that a blanket ban on any felony conviction is a real no-go, and you're opening yourself up to a separate impact lawsuit. So I think that's a huge step forward.
For all housing.
Yeah. So I think that's the kind of thing we can really build on, and, I'm excited. So, and I know, at a state level, when you call Fair Housing Council, they're already telling landlords, private landlords, that a blanket ban is not a great, is not preferred and is something that's going to open you up to a lawsuit. But now there's a lot more weight behind that statement. So,
okay. We may want to coordinate with the local HUD office, maybe for a presentation or something.
I think, Madam.
Hey, Michael.
Yeah.
This is Julie on the phone. Just it's really hollow for whoever's speaking, so I don't know if that's because of the distance of the speaker, but or the Polycom thing. But just FYI, people back in the room are talking.
Oh, it's
the, we're not hearing anything. I don't think on the phone. So.
Okay. Thanks for reminding us of that, Julie.
Representative Parrish, you can also listen on the computer as well.
Oh, great. Mm-hmm. That might be just it. Okay, how do I get there? Is that just...
That's through the OLIS site.
Yeah, just look for...
On the Oregon Legislative Information site.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You should be able to locate our task force under task forces, and then there should be a link to listen to the meeting.
Oh, awesome. Thank you.
great.
I do think that having further discussion, having someone in to come in to go over that information with us, as well as, and Janet, you may know what's occurring with the voucher systems and whether or not that action on HUD will help move that along. So I think this is, thanks, Jeremy, I think this is a huge breakthrough.
And I have one more thing. So in honor of National Reentry Week, my organization kind of threw together a last-minute celebration of, you know, what's working in reentry in hopes, you know, now this is an annual event, next year will be bigger and better. But we did a very small ask for funds. We didn't expect to get much. But we raised $500 last night, which is not a lot of money, except the vast majority of it came from our clients who chose to donate, which a lot of our clients are not in great positions. And the fact that they chose to open their wallets and say, you know, I support this work was like very humbling to me. And I think really speaks to sort of like, you know, they weren't just supporting Mercy Corps there. They were supporting the programs that, you know, the county's working with, the district attorneys working with, all of these people were speaking at the event. And I thought that was really impressive. And I mean, just really speaks to sort of like the people going through this are invested and, you know, want to turn around and give back. So I think it's very exciting for the work we're doing and, you know, fills me with passion. So
that's great. Thanks, Jeremy. Yeah. Serena and I were at a meeting this morning on enhancing diversity in the workforce, and somebody there at my table mentioned the event last night, said it was great, very inspiring.
Awesome.
Yeah. Okay. Well, why don't we anybody have anything else they want to mention along those lines? Okay, if not, let's go on and talk about short-term transition leave and alternative incarceration plans. These were things that came up at our last meeting, and, you know, we thought, boy, this is something we'd like to know more about. How do these work? Are they being used as much as they should be? What are the effects of them? So, Cindy, you're going to talk about it, and yes. Nick, you're going to talk about the alternative incarceration.
Sure.
And then, Mike, you're going to talk to us about short-term leave. And thanks a lot for stepping forward to do that.
You want me to get started? So on the short-term transition leave part of it, I brought a report. I think all of you have a copy of it. And I brought enough for other folks in the room, too. And if you don't get a copy, it's also on the Criminal Justice Commission website. But this program, short-term transitional leave, predates House Bill 3194. It existed before that. But it really kind of came into focus through that legislation. Before House Bill 3194 or the Justice Reinvestment Bill passed in 2013, short-term trans leave was kind of a little-used program and option for Department of Corrections where they could transition somebody in the last 30 days of their DOC custody into the community to kind of build that bridge. And it really wasn't used that frequently. But the legislation in 2013 expanded that 30 days to 90 days and tasked the Department of Corrections with making rules to make sure that people who are eligible for it could receive that option. So really, it's been the legislation passed in 2013, and we saw the first wave, if you will, of people getting the 90-day short-term trans leave start in about January of 2014. And it was just a trickle at first. But then as people were serving their sentences and they were going through, more and more people were eligible for the 90 days, as well as Department of Corrections made a real effort to even utilize the 30 days for those people who are eligible for that. And the counties really responded very well with making sure that when people were eligible for short-term trans leave, that they were planning and making sure they had a place to go and communicating with Department of Corrections. That was one of the big requirements, is that you have to have housing approved. And so the counties really stepped up with their communication and Department of Corrections as well. And so what we have now today is a program that has been going since essentially January 1st of 14. That's when it really started to tick up. And the bulk of people, as you'll see when you thumb through the report, now are 90-day short-term trans leavers. There aren't as many of the 30 days left. So the program as it goes today, there's approximately around 100 to a little bit more than that every month that are exiting the Department of Corrections 90 days before their sentence is completed. And they're serving that remaining 90 days in the community. And so, like I said, those are people who have case plan, they have housing, it's been approved by the counties, they're working in coordination with Department of Corrections. So the report that you have in front of you is something that the Criminal Justice Commission prepared in January 1st of this year, or around January of this year, to look at, well, now that people have been getting this for several years, how do they do on supervision? What is the impact that this program has on recidivism? Are the people who are receiving that 90 days any worse in terms of recidivism, better, the same? And really the analysis from a state perspective was this is a cost-saving effort to decrease prison bed utilization, right? So if the groups were recidivating at exactly the same rate, then nobody was worse off. And so we wanted to see, are they recidivating at a higher rate? Well, to cut to the chase of this report, what you find at the end of this is statistically significant numbers of a reduction in recidivism after 1 year across all three of our statewide measures. If you receive short-term trans leave and transition into the community for the last 90 days, you are statistically significantly less likely to be arrested within 1 year, to be convicted within 1 year, and to be reincarcerated in 1 year. So obviously, when we talk about recidivism, our statewide definition is not just 1 year long, it's 3 years. So we only have 1 year of data because that's how long the program has been in existence that we could see people out for a year. So we'll continue to build on this. But from the perspective of justice reinvestment, whose goals were to both decrease our utilization of DOC resources, but at the same time, promote and protect public safety and reduce recidivism. The results of this report were very, very good for us. I mean, we really felt pretty impressed by by what has been happening through the collaboration Department of Corrections and the counties who are making this work. I don't need to go through the report slide or page by page, but in this you can see demographic information. We break it down by gender. So male and female, many people on this committee are aware that our female offender population is at a tipping point in terms of our capacity to house them. The good news about short-term trans leave, you'll see that female offenders are 17% of the trans leave population, and they're approximately 9% of our overall prison population. So they're more likely to receive it than their male counterparts. You can see the crime type breakdown. And when you get to pages 5 and 6, you can see the number of people who are successfully completing this. We have a 5% failure rate on short-term trans leave. That's 5% of people who are returned back into Department of Corrections. 95% of people aren't. And then on page 6, you can see that 91% of all the people who received short-term trans leave didn't even receive a jail sanction in their last 90 days. So they weren't even being violating their probation in such a way, or their supervision in such a way, that they'd be sanctioned by local jail. And that was a big concern, frankly, around the 3194 conversation was, is this just a shift of prison to local jail? So what you find out is that the local jail beds that were used are not even close to the amount of prison beds that were saved when you talk about how few people violate that supervision in the last 90 days. So to be clear, what this report does not say is that the short-term trans leave program causes a reduction in recidivism. The people who receive short-term trans leave are people who are compliant on the inside with their treatment goals, with their case planning. They are eligible statutorily for this, and they get this as an incentive on the inside to be able to make that transition. So naturally, when you compare them to people who didn't receive it, you're kind of not comparing apples to apples, right? You're comparing people who are doing well and doing their treatment on the inside versus people who are not eligible for some reason. So this report does not say that this caused a reduction in recidivism, but what it does say is that the people who are receiving short-term trans leave are the right candidates. They are performing better. We are getting a public safety gain, even with them spending 90 days less in Department of Corrections.
But my question, doesn't also support the notion of the reaching in, and I'm talking about now, with parole and probation reaching in and actually starting the planning work and all the transition to move back into the community, and one piece you forgot to add to the housing, in collaboration and work with the Oregon Health Authority, we're getting that health piece so there's a continuation from the institution back to the community as well. So it's that 90 days to dot some of the I's and cross some of the T's so that the person returning back to the community, whether it's a driver's license and some of those other issues of returning, that they're actually being handled.
You're absolutely correct, Senator. This program could be driving a reduction in recidivism, but this report, you could not hold this report up and say it proves that it does. Those things are all factors that other people who are spending that last 90 days in Department of Corrections might not have all of the things that you just described and therefore are more likely to recidivate. But this report, we didn't study that, is what I'm saying. But it's certainly a good possibility and one that makes sense to a lot of people who have been doing reentry work for a long time. So it's very promising, and in terms of the way we looked at this with Justice Reinvestment, it's been a huge success in terms of the prison beds saved and getting better public safety results.
Yes, Eddie?
I can ask a question. Is this comparison, because you said the requirement was to have housing, is it a comparison to people who had housing and went out on 90 days and people who had housing and released on their regular release date, or is it a comparison of people who had housing 90 days and everybody else?
And everybody else.
Okay.
And it's a good question. We actually did try to do a matched analysis. And so we did it both ways. We looked at people who received it versus everybody else. But then we actually looked at the people who received it and tried to find their counterpart in the system, so controlling for demographics, age, education, risk level, those kinds of things. We tried to control for some of those variables and then saw if there was still a statistical significant difference between recidivism, and we found that there was. It held up even with a matched analysis.
And I want to add that when we say that they have housing, that housing may be subsidized by the county or by DOC. So I just want to point out, in Multnomah County, we have close to 300 beds that we contract out for people coming out of prison and jail. So,
yeah, I see the public safety checklist, but was there any breakdown of, like, people getting out in their LCMI risk level? Like, was that factored into who is eligible for a 90-day trans leave? Like, were high risk or medium or low risk, was that accounted for?
In terms of if you were high risk, would you not be eligible to receive a short-term trans leave? No, I don't believe that's the case. I think that as long as you're compliant with your programming within the institution and you are statutorily eligible. So, for example, if you had a mandatory sentence, you wouldn't be statutorily eligible for this. But if you didn't, then you could be considered for it.
So what kind of support the inmates receive during this 90 days? I mean, they're going to have housing provided, but, you know, in terms of frequency of contact with the caseworker and, you know, all of that, what's there for them?
I'm going to pass the ball to Truls on that question.
So, and again, I would represent more the bigger counties, Multnomah County, Washington, Marion County, and Clackamas County. I think we've spent quite a bit of money in our respective counties with 3194, and even prior to that with local county funding on providing housing, mentoring, I think has been a key component, alcohol and drug treatment, employment readiness. In Multnomah County specifically, we do like what we call a multidisciplinary team that meets every week to staff each case and to make sure they're on the right path. When Mike talks about the 90 days, I think other folks would echo that it's not the 90 days release that really makes the big impact. It may be the stick, but it's the stick of going back to prison, but it's the services that we're able to provide and collaborate on and get folks on the right track and in a solid direction. So, Anybody else want to add anything?
To your question, Senator, I think it probably looks different county by county.
Yes.
And probably the counties that have less resources, it's probably not as much wraparound as what Truls described.
Mm-hmm. Is there an employment component to it?
In the bigger counties, there are. I know Commissioner Carlson, you do employment as well, right?
Right. We have a person that helps with resume writing and job application. But one of the things that's important to note is that a person who comes out may or may not be ready to be employed, and we want them to be successful in that. So actually doing the assessments, getting them into treatment if that's what they need, cognitive behavioral therapy before treatment if that's what they need, and then the employment comes as subsequently, because it doesn't do us any good to get someone a job and then they don't do well in that job.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the cost savings, so what are we looking at? There's still housing is being provided, and there is casework, etc. There's still some expense, right? How much would we be saving for each inmate? I suppose that differs county to county as well, but just kind of looking at it globally.
Yeah, well, one of the things that we're really interested with justice reinvestment, when the legislature passed that legislation, it was they didn't want to have to build another prison. And so I just did this analysis the other day, and it was just quick math on the back of a napkin. But where we are today compared to where we would have been without this legislation is about 460 prison beds difference. Now, that's not to say short-term transleave is all of that savings, but it certainly is a significant portion of that. So without the transleave portion of that difference in our prison beds, we would definitely be probably would have already gone to the legislature to have to start the process of building another facility in Junction City. You can look at it on a per bed per day rate, which is a tough kind of number to hit because it depends on institution, but we would have crossed the tipping point of having to build a brand new institution that would be there and then you have to run. So, the cost savings is huge from that perspective. And like I mentioned on the jail side, the cost shift, we really haven't seen that. But as you know, the counties are doing and investing in a lot of the wraparound services that are attendant to this. But it's still got a pale in comparison to the cost that we would have borne. But I haven't done that specific analysis, Senator, the dollar for dollar.
I ask a question as a new guy. What exactly happens here? So you're assessed, you're deemed like you should be one of the folks that participates in this program. You get out. There's housing available. You've got some wraparound services going on. So the goal is by the end of the 30 days or 90 days that you've got a job and you're on your way, that you've kind of established yourself a little bit. That's part of what you're talking about in success rates, and here's what's happening. Okay.
Thanks. Right. And so not successful completion would be you actually got pulled back into the prison to finish out your time.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
I don't know if this is getting into the weeds too much, but do you know or could you maybe speak towards the mechanism of someone who is going to be paroling back to Multnomah County, eligible for 90 days, and needs a bed? How does that process go? Because I certainly, less so in Multnomah County, but since January, I get an uptick in my office of sort of the beleaguered wife or relative calling about a much more rural county, being we just got the call, John Doe is eligible to get out, but I need to find him housing, and he can't. It's the mad scramble. It's trying to figure out if a motel address will count. It seems like we're doing a much better job of that in Multnomah County. I don't know, but I was wondering if you could.
I can only speak to Multnomah County, but I will tell you but I know a lot of other counties, the bigger counties, kind of mirror this, is we do reach in up to 90 days prior to release and figure out what needs each person inmate needs, medication, housing, all those kind of factors are looked at. Mm-hmm. And then we have a cadre of housing that we contract for. What sometimes happens, because I hear a little bit of this coming from Mercy Corps, your navigators, is we'll have folks who don't like the housing we can provide, and so they refuse that, and we can't make them take the housing. Now, on the short-term transleave, they have to have some kind of housing plan that we approve and the institution approves. So I'm kind of mixing the just the post-prison folks, but to come to any county from another county, they have to go through a process. That's, and I think I heard you were talking a little bit about that as well. So did that answer your question?
Yeah. So it's just DCJ is going into InReach and basically classifying folks as sort of like they're going to parole out into the Bridges for Change housing, sort of like a wait list almost. Yes. And kind of, okay.
And some housing, we can't house sex offenders and arsonists in residential housing. We have to use some of our housing that's downtown.
Yeah.
And that's usually the less desirable housing for lots of reasons. Yeah. So.
Well, don't worry. I'm always telling them it's a good deal.
So, when does the reach-in start in advance of the, the short-term transition?
I said typically 60 to 90 days. Is that pretty accurate, Cindy?
So this would be 180 days before release. You would start having those conversations, or?
Senator Dimbrough, looking at the short-term transitional leave date being the date that they would leave prison, then counties are looking at 60 to 90 days prior to that date. So the short-term TL date becomes their release from prison date. And they're, most counties are averaging at least 90 days. Some counties, Marion, Lane County, often come in 6 months prior to release, regardless of the release status, because they have programs that the individuals may be eligible for, and they begin working with them sooner to make that transition more efficient and effective.
Mm-hmm.
And they have very good report rates as a result, reporting for supervision as a result of that.
We had considerable discussion on this particular provision in 3194, and I'm pleased to know that we're being successful. And I critical to that is the reach-in, and whether it is the 90 days or as Marion County and Lane are doing, and some of the officers are going in prior to that, because it does prepare the individual for a plan and the two working together for ultimately return back to the community. We found that in addition to the need for housing, and I mentioned medical because that became a huge discussion when we were going through talking about reentry back into the community, and can we facilitate and make certain that there's a continuation. The challenge, however, are communities that are there and whether or not they have the resources available. You know, we often, at this level, talk in broad terms, and what we find is that not all communities have the resource availability to carry out what they're doing in Multnomah County or Clackamas County. I continue to be envious of Clackamas County because their investment in housing probably makes the other counties look pretty pale in comparison to how they're structured and how they're geared. But it does point out, and I think as a state that we need a resource mapping to know what exists throughout the state, because all is not equal when we start talking about some of the programs that are on the books. And I think I've had the conversation with Mike on our, because I think we'll continue the 3194 discussion. But it is true, the resource, it does come down to resource availability in the various counties.
Yeah, Cindy, what's the progress that you've made with signing people up for the Oregon Health Plan? Because with the expansion, I know that mm-hmm. changed quite a bit, and you were kind of the last group to get noticed, I guess, in the state level discussion.
Yes, thank you for asking. Actually, we are, I think, very much ahead in that category in a couple of ways.
So for the age 19 to 64 that are part of the Affordable Care expansion of Medicaid, we average 350-plus applications every month for persons that are releasing, whether they're releasing to their projected release date or short-term trans leave date or AIP non-prison date, which I'll talk about in a little bit. So regardless of the release status, we're able to enroll them through Oregon Health Authority for Medicaid services. And the majority, it's very rare that we have a rejection. And then for ages 65 and older, we do apply for what's called traditional Medicaid, which is an assets and income-based process. That we have less success with because of the amount of time it takes for the person to be found eligible, and the asset and income limitations being $2,000. So one of the things we have long requested is, you know, that the conversation up to Capitol Hill include changing traditional Medicaid eligibility to match that of the new MAGI, the Affordable Care Act expansion. But not to belabor that issue, we average about 400 to 425 releases per month right now. So the majority of individuals were able to enroll, and they have Medicaid coverage at release. Senator Winters has been very clear over the years that having that coverage is critical, but also she has championed the conversation around the need for services being available. A person can be eligible, but depending on where they are in the state, they may not have an opportunity to see someone who will take Medicaid in a timely manner. And so we struggle often in arranging post-release appointments for individuals who need continuing care around medications that require a prescriber. So those are some of the challenges that we're working through. We have very specific transition medical and mental health nurses who help arrange care and continuity of care for individuals who are releasing. But it is a challenge, depending on where the person's going in the state. We last year applied for and were the only state agency to receive an Oregon Health Authority federal grant to help us pay for another enrollment assister. We had previously repurposed a position within the Department of Corrections to serve as an enrollment assister. We do individual one-on-one application assistance, and only if we are pressed because of an immediate release do we do a phone interview with the individual. Otherwise, it's face-to-face. So these staff are traveling around the state and meeting with these individuals to submit the application and to ensure that the individual is of the understanding that what their services will be once they release with regard to Medicaid. So we have that federal grant, which ends in June. We are applying for another in hopes that that will fund an enrollment assister into the next year.
So. I've got to say, I mean, on the ground level of people getting out, I came into the reentry world to help assist in 2013 to help enroll people as they were getting out. The work that the state has done and the work that Multnomah County did effectively made I didn't have a job. I mean, the people that were getting out, the vast majority of them, we are seeing that they are enrolled. I mean, it became my job was like, here's the number to just double check. So I then got moved into housing. But I mean, I think from a reentry nonprofit standpoint, we're seeing people getting out that are enrolled, and the push there is just to get them actually to the doctor. Now we're not dealing with getting them enrolled. We're not dealing with waiting. It's actually like getting them services. So that part of the battle has been really great, and I think Oregon's doing an amazing job. So thank you.
That's great. Okay, well, why don't we move on to the AIP presentation, and then if other questions come up around the short-term transition, certainly we could pursue those as well. So, Cindy, you want to start, or Nick?
If I may, and I'll do the boring part, the statutory and administrative rules side of the alternative incarceration program and let Nick talk about what's really important, having firsthand knowledge of and experience with the program, and I think talk about the values. So as you heard from Mr. Schmidt, the short-term trans leave program did have history with the Oregon Department of Corrections for a 30-day period of time. DOC also operates two types of alternative incarceration programs that are statutorily authorized. We began alternative incarceration program in 1994. It was the original Shutter Creek program, and it was a boot camp model. A few years later, we established an AIP program at the Powder River facility in Baker City, and that was an intensive alcohol and drug program, where the Summit program in Shutter Creek was more of a cognitive approach on a military-style program that involved marching and calisthenics, and I think it really was a boot camp model. In brief, the alternative incarceration program is statutorily authorized. One thing that is similar to the short-term TL program is that the judgment order for the individual inmate must state that they are eligible for an alternative incarceration program. But more importantly, it must affirmatively state such and also be read in open court. So the individual, it has to be on the court record that they are eligible. Our offender information sentence computation folks look closely at the judgment orders to make sure the language is appropriate and adequate, and when necessary, will contact the court to confirm their wishes for that individual to either be eligible for short-term AIP or not. In addition, they must meet the statutory requirements for an alternative incarceration program. And one of the reasons is because AIP affords individuals a time cut if they qualify and are able to get into a program. So different from short-term TL, which actually moves their release date up, if you will, their release from prison date, alternative incarceration programs, depending on when the person was sentenced, can be a significant time cut from their prison time. So there are two phases. The institution phase of the program, 14 hours at a minimum, 7 days a week of highly structured engagement with the individuals. They live in an environment with others that are in the program. So it's a milieu that is designed to be supportive of the alternative incarceration perspective, and also asks that individuals embrace change rapidly and completely. So it's designed to be an intensive opportunity to change their lives for the better, whether it's in the cognitive program or those who are receiving the intensive A&D treatment. The intent is that the handoff to the community corrections supervision during their non-prison leave status affords them an opportunity to continue with what they have learned during that 6 months in prison during that program stay. As part of the required 270 days at a minimum for an AIP participation is an opportunity for up to 90 days of non-prison leave. It used to be called transitional leave, but it was changed to non-prison leave by the legislature a few sessions ago to better distinguish it. The opportunity is to live in the community, to work, to continue treatment if appropriate, and persons on non-prison leave are held to a higher standard. Their conditions for supervision are very specific to AIP, and they roll into their post-prison supervision time if they're successful. But the ability for a person to be returned to prison because they are not successful in the community is much greater. So if someone is out on non-prison leave and they are not doing well, then it's more likely they would be returned to prison. And if they are returned to prison, they must complete the entire sentence that they would have otherwise had a time cut for. So as an example, if someone gets a 6-month time cut because they were in AIP, but they are not doing well on non-prison leave, they come back to prison, they lose earned time, they have to do the rest of their sentence, and they've greatly jeopardized their future opportunities. Often it destabilizes their housing and employment opportunities as well.
So on average, how many are in the program?
Statewide, we have about 775 every year that go through the program.
And how many are returned to complete their sentence?
I need to double-check those statistics, but I'm aware of only one individual returned in the last year for a reason where the violation was upheld. So we will get those statistics to you over time. Many of the counties, I think it's important to mention this, many of the counties have POs that are specifically assigned to supervise individuals on non-prison leave because they're familiar with the program requirements both on the inside of the facility as well as what's available in the community for these individuals. So having these POs very familiar with AIP itself and non-prison leave has proven very helpful. And I think Nick should share his experiences and also talk about how sponsors approaches the AIP individuals.
Sure.
So
in Lane County, with sponsors, we really try hard to remove a lot of the barriers that the clients have when they come in from the alternative incarceration programs. And like Cindy just said, we are one of the counties that have a designated parole officer that is an AIP-specific parole officer. And one of the great things about, amongst many things that's great about sponsors, is that that PO's office is located right on our property at sponsors. So the individual leaves the prison, they come to sponsors, and the way that it typically goes is within 24 hours, of course, they check in with their parole officer, but also right on site at sponsors, we have case managers who are able to meet with them within a couple hours of their arrival and put together a comprehensive case plan. And that comprehensive case plan takes a look at what they exited the AIP program with as far as, you know, maybe stipulations or how they completed treatment. And when they meet with that case manager, the case manager is then in turn able to get them connected with any necessary ancillary services. So, for instance, a lot of the folks that come out of the AIP drug program are required to do some sort of aftercare. So we have a contract with a local treatment provider, and that local treatment provider comes right to sponsors onto our property and does these groups right on our property. So the individual, in theory, doesn't have to leave our property for anything that they do. So a lot of the times people have had struggles in the past with, you know, they have to take a bus over here to do this service or a bus to do here to this service. And it can be overwhelming to somebody, especially when they're just getting out of prison. So having that stuff right on property is a big key to success. And one of the things that Cindy was talking about is maybe the stipulations for an AIP person being a little bit more stringent than it would be a traditional person releasing. So we incorporate those things into the case plan as well. So we're in communication with the AIP PO that says this person's going to be required to do 3 to 4 outside support meetings. They're going to be required to check in daily with me until they get a job. And so we support that person throughout that process. Right on property at sponsors, we have the Reentry Resource Center, which the person is checked in the next morning, and they work with a job developer to put together a resume and to get sent out on qualified job leads. That and the job leads that they're getting sent out are not just want ads on the computer, but they're employers that we know to be people that give second chances to folks that have records. So we have a board full of employers, and we're having incredibly good luck getting people a job within just a couple of weeks when they get out of prison. So it's the idea of removing those barriers from those individuals and getting them to the spot where they can feel more confident about the things that they're able to do. Along with the job and the PO being right on site, we're able to give folks bus passes. So when they do get that job, they can get right out there into the community and get engaged, because some folks come out of prison with no money or with no assets or no ability to be able to do that. So the bus pass, while it may seem small, is a significant hurdle for some folks to overcome. Our AIP PO in Lane County requires all of the people that are AIP individuals to do weekly accountability meetings. So she has, in our conference room, meets with them once a week to do a real thorough check-in to see, hey, how you guys doing, and is everything going okay, and what's going on, what can we do to help? So let's see. So in addition to working with those individuals with case management, towards the end of their what are we calling it now? I'm sorry, the non-prison. Yeah. Towards the end of the non-prison leave, case managers are working with folks on exit strategies and also working on self-sufficiency plans. So what does this look like to you for you to get out into the community to get your own residence? And Sponsors has some properties around the area as well, too, that if a person does really well, we can get them plugged into those different houses. But the focus is on making that person successful and making that plan with a date in mind to where when they do transition, when they do move out into the community, they have the greatest chance of success.
Yeah. So where are they living when they're, you know, in that program?
So we have, at Sponsors, we have a 74 bed facility right where I was just speaking about, where the administrative offices are, where the folks do their treatment, where they do cognitive classes.
And elsewhere around the state, again, it differs by county, but individuals are required to have housing approved by the county before they're allowed to go out on AIP non-prison leave, same as short-term transitional leave. And one of the things I think is important about individuals nearing or while they're on non-prison leave, and if they're struggling, one of the opportunities under AIP is that we have multidisciplinary interventions. So the PO, the treatment provider in the community if they are continuing treatment, the facility staff, and our administrative staff will have a conference call that includes the individual and talk about their behavior or what's occurring in the community. And if it is not something where they've committed a new crime, the intent is to identify what supports and resources can be put around the individual so they can remain in the community and be successful, perhaps with a short sanction, rather than returning them to prison, which at the end of the day is very costly, more than just the amount of the prison bed or the supervision costs. The individual may be losing employment opportunities or housing opportunities, that if we can provide some short-term supports, they can maintain that community placement and do well.
Cindy, are all counties participating?
Yes. So it's based on the individual's sentence and judgment order and their statutory eligibility. Yes. And Truls, I don't know if you have, from a community corrections perspective, or if you or Commissioner Carlson have experience with AIP you'd like to share.
Well, for us, AIP is very similar to the STTL. I sometimes blur them in my mind because they look the same in terms of the client coming out. But we do basically very similar to Sponsors. We have the mentors that usually help us with the reach-ins with the parole and probation officers. And then we have a multidisciplinary team that also staffs those cases. And again, they don't just staff the AIPs, they staff the STTLs, and we have another program called REC that they also staff. So, provide basically very similar services.
So at the end of the day, what is the difference then between STTL and AIP? I mean, in practice, on the ground?
For alternative incarceration programs, they go through contracted services through the Department of Corrections. So we contract with organizations to provide the intensive treatment or the intensive living environment and to manage the milieu.
So that would be Sponsors and for some of them, yes?
No, on the inside, it's different providers. For example, West Care. Up at the Columbia River and
New Directions
at Powder River. Yeah. So they're contracted services the department pays for, and they are, the individuals are in living units that support the milieu. They eat, sleep, recreate with the same individuals. It's a community approach to changing criminal behavior. And perhaps the most important piece is if AIP is primarily for individuals at highest risk to reoffend.
Right.
The short-term TL is going to be based on statutory eligibility and their in-institution behavior.
So there's a difference in the institutional, alternative institutional phase.
Yes.
But then once they're in the community phase, then the two look a lot alike.
They're somewhat similar, but the AIP non-prison leave, again, is more intensive. The supervision approach is more intensive. The opportunities and wraparound services are more significant, and the stakes are higher for the individual because of what they risk losing.
What's your recidivism numbers on that population group?
Senator Winters, I don't have this in the moment. But
because I think it would be good to actually do some comparison and look at what really is the outcome with that group. Particularly, you're talking about a very controlled environment with very intense cognitive behavior and some things that's mm-hmm. going on. And so here we have another group that's not, even though it's not at that quote high risk. And I know from the standpoint of the book that we're doing under 3194 that it would be mm-hmm. very good to capture, you know, what are the outcomes.
Yes.
So if I may interject something else, too, another significant difference between the short-term trans leave and the AIP programs, mm-hmm. and Cindy just talked about that a second ago, is that the short-term trans leave folks are finishing out the last of their 90 days on the outside, whereas the AIP folks are getting a time cut. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot more left to lose there. Mm-hmm. And
there's a bigger stick.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that could be a significant time cut, too.
Depending on the individual, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Janet, from a county perspective, what is your sense of how well this is all working?
So I don't have as much specific information about AIP in Marion County, but I do know we don't have the structured housing like they do in Multnomah and Lane County. I mean, I've been down to Sponsors so many times, probably at least once a year for the last 7 years, and really appreciate what they have there. And Multnomah County, it sounds like they actually have apartments that they operate. We work with community providers. We have some housing that we partner with Union Gospel Mission for. We have Restoration House for sex offenders that they will take people there. But again, there's a religious component to that some people, you know, people voluntarily have to agree to that. So there's, you know, it's not like everybody would be appropriate for that setting. And I know that we have housing stipends that we use to help people get into housing just in the private market, lists of landlords, that kind of thing. We are looking at building 24 units out on the jail campus that, if things go well, it would be ready in a couple of years. But I think housing is a major challenge for many counties. And in Marion County, it's been probably our biggest gap. I mean, we have a lot of other services that we provide. We're getting better, but we're still not.
And I think the larger counties like Marion and Multnomah, certainly Lane, Clackamas, others, with the transition centers, you know, kind of that one stop for individuals that are either on probation or otherwise justice involved on release, is critically important because it's somewhere they can go to get information and assistance for some of those wraparound services. But absolutely, finding appropriate housing that they can secure is few and far between.
You know, one of the, obviously one of the real tasks of this task force is to look at ways to make it easier for ex-offenders to get employment,
right,
and to be prepared, you know, to find jobs. And, you know, I'm wondering, again, that component of these programs. You know, I know that, you know, there's a lot of programming that happens both in the institutional phase and in the release phase, but what are we doing in terms of getting people into employment?
So
that's something we could be doing more of, or into skill building, education, training.
So the Department of Corrections does have education services, but they, to say they're adequate would be untrue. And the mode through which we have education available is antiquated. And I'm sure Mr. Alves could speak more about that, probably for days. But there are efforts around skill building and specifically around soft skills, so learning to take direction and the ability to create an environment where someone can learn in the last months of incarceration what it is to make decisions on their own, you know, without being told when to get up, what time to go to bed, and all of that. It's nearly impossible in an institution setting, but there are some units that are able to do pieces of that, and the alternative incarceration programs do include more of an opportunity for individuals to be responsible for themselves and to begin making decisions and developing plans for their post-release life. They have access to some information, again, very limited, but some information about where they're releasing to that they can use and start reaching out. In addition to the discussions with the PO, they're able to write, for example, to individuals or organizations that are in the community that might be of assistance to them. But again, it's within very structured settings, and the transition classes that are offered them, while voluntary, they're encouraged to participate in, because it does give them the foundations of looking for employment, securing employment, and being a good employee, as well as finding and securing housing, which includes something that used to be available through Oregon Housing and Community Services. They used to have a certificate program for renters where rent could be guaranteed. They no longer have that funding available. It's changed, but we still teach those classes so that individuals can have reasonable conversations with landlords about renting or leasing from them and proving themselves through that process. And as Mr. Nichols talked about earlier, the HUD communications have been very helpful. And we today, on the Medicaid conversation just today, Health and Human Services in D.C. issued clarification on Medicaid coverage for individuals on probation, parole, in-home supervision, and halfway houses. So they've clarified language so that around the country there's a better understanding these individuals are eligible for Medicaid, even though they're in that status. One of the barriers that does remain, however, and this is something I think it's difficult for community corrections agencies to understand because it doesn't happen all that often, but when a person is on short-term trans leave or AIP non-prison leave or second look conditional release, they're still considered an inmate. And in the eyes of the federal government, for Social Security purposes, they are not eligible for Social Security benefits during that period of time. So some individuals, it may be recommended that they not receive short-term transitional leave, for example, because they need a level of care where Social Security benefits are critical for payment. of services, and they can't get that during that up to 90 days of short-term trans leave. So a recommendation is put forward, a decision is made whether or not the individual's physical or mental health would preclude them from doing well on short-term trans leave because they don't have that Social Security benefit.
Mr. Chair, at some point, I think that I hope this group actually look at what are we offering as far as preparing the individual for the work. We you and I started this conversation and talked about employment and housing. My comment was that if you don't have a place to lay your head and you don't have the ability to earn a living, we're going to guarantee the people return back to the institutions. If the individuals don't have at least some skill set with which to offer in the world, I think we also are putting up another barrier. And whether it is that we do a cataloging of what does exist, I know Eddie's saying yes. What preparation are we doing or not? What is it? And those are pro and probation when they come out. What is the difficulties in actually getting assisting in getting the person employment? We went through this and doing Ban the Box, and both the good senator and I said that was not enough just to that particular legislation. So that gets you the interview. There's other pieces to getting a job. So I would hope that we actually do a little more diving into this particular issue and the preparation, and whether, and I'm sure that I see the enterprise is sitting over there on that side of talking about how they can maybe connect with some of this.
Right. Yeah. And how an individual gets put on a path where, each of these makes sense and they connect, the training that they receive while they're incarcerated to the placement that they're going to have if they're on short-term transitional leave or AIP, if there's some sort of overall path, that would be useful to know. So just before we let this go, and we'll have to move on, one last question. These two programs are statutorily laid out, are there any changes that we might want to be looking at in terms of, making them more successful, or are there any limitations that are current that maybe made sense at one time but are making less sense now? Not to put you on the spot, but
Mr. Chair, one thing, so in our other work on the 3194 task force, one of the things they asked us to do, of course, because that group is very concerned with the mandates of that bill, which is one of which is decreased prison usage, was to look at what it would happen if we expanded short-term trans leave to 120 days in terms of the prison population, or 150 days or 180 days. We did the statistical work on what that would look like in terms of prison savings and all of that. But one of the things that I think that we need to be cognizant of is that these two programs aren't working against each other. We wouldn't want to disincentivize people from going into AIP because short-term trans leave is an easier or a path of less resistance for someone who's like, well, I'll get some time off doing that, and I'd rather do that than doing the hard work of AIP. So I think whatever any kind of concepts that come up, we have to keep that in mind. And I think if we were going to make any statutory changes, we'd want to maybe think of them as more of a singular option or parts of a program instead of completely distinct and different paths that somebody could go down, because we don't want to change the incentives for folks on the inside to take advantage of these programs. So it's not a recommendation to your question, but just something I think that we should be mindful of, and not trying to, if we do change anything, to look at those incentives.
I would echo that. Senators Winter and Dimbro. The concern is that an expansion of short-term TL, just on the face of it, could de-incentivize individuals from AIP because of changes made in 2009 around those who qualify for AIP, the crimes, and the time cut that they would potentially receive. For some individuals, it would clearly be a better path to take short-term trans leave than to engage in an alternative incarceration program, being held to a higher standard and have not that much to lose. So there are, it could be a balance in the future, a delicate balance. We'd have to look at it.
Two questions on the alternative. One is, what's the average sentencing length at that population group? Because you're talking about, and you said they were a higher risk. If I,
the focus is on those that are higher risk to reoffend. Yes. Yeah. So for those intensive programs.
For those intensive programs.
Yes.
So where the other, the risk factor doesn't play into it, right?
Correct.
So that's the distinction between.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if, and it would be good to see the statistics,
right,
you know, over the years. But if you only know of one person in the last year who's, you know, been sent back.
And I'm aware of.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty good, especially, I mean, it's more than pretty good,
well,
given the population we're talking
yeah.
about.
But in fairness to that, you know, individuals have to earn that opportunity for the 90-day non-prison leave. So they may have been in the program but not successful, and so they didn't go out on non-prison leave, and so that opportunity was lost. Or the intervention while they were on non-prison leave was sufficient to keep them in the community and they didn't have to come back. So it isn't without work and effort on community corrections and everyone's part to ensure that the person can be as successful as possible. They, our hope is that they really have to mess up to earn their way back to prison off of non-prison leave.
What's the cost of this one versus the other? And,
well,
and at some point we're going to get asked that question because it's a budget question.
Absolutely.
You are.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Senator Winters, please let us get that information back to
you
because short-term trans leave, in effect, doesn't have a cost because the individual
right.
is not in
and
program.
And the other one does because you're talking about intensive wraparound.
Well, it's a program.
It's a program, yeah.
And I would just say, if I may add, the short-term trans leave is a cost savings
yes,
to the state.
Right.
For jail, for prison beds, but it is a cost to the counties
correct.
For providing services.
And that, hopefully that, you get to retain some of those dollars.
Exactly.
Okay, well, great. Thanks. This is very, very helpful. So let's move on to the prison enterprises.
Well, I apologize that I don't have handouts for everyone, but I will try my best to make this work good for everyone, as long as the clicker works appropriately. So you're gonna.
Perfect. Thanks.
Well, thank you for inviting us here today. We really appreciate it. I brought a couple of my managers with me to support me if there's some information that's needed. So I'll start off with the history and the structure of OCE, Oregon Corrections Enterprise, and I'll refer to Oregon Corrections Enterprise as OCE from here on out. But the authority with Oregon Corrections Enterprise is to engage the eligible inmates in state corrections institutions in work or on-the-job training. The authority is subject to the authority granted to me from the Director of the Department of Corrections by Section 41, Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution, and to any rules or orders issued by the Director regarding care, custody, and control of inmates. We also have a disposition of our income and revenues. All of our revenues and incomes generated or received by the Oregon Corrections Enterprises shall remain within and continuously appropriated to Oregon Corrections Enterprises for the purpose of discharging the functions and duties prescribed by Section 41, Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution. And important is that all of our funds cannot be commingled with the Department of Corrections. Next. So we recreated our mission
after I came here 2.5 years ago. And our mission directly supports that of the Department of Corrections, where ultimately the two agencies share the fundamental goals to improve public safety. We really need to work in partnership with the Department of Corrections instead of trying to be individual, and that's key to our success. So the legislature established OCE as a semi-independent agency to ensure that all the work and all the on-the-job training programs are cost-effective, designed to develop inmate motivation, work capabilities, cooperation, and a successful transition into the community. Next. So this is our participation history. Kind of gives you a look at the numbers that are involved. So from the early 2000s, the number of inmates participating in OCE's program grew steady. In the past, inmate growth was attributed to large manufacturing jobs such as building prisons. And however, during the recession, our manufacturing work opportunities have declined. We actually lose money in those areas. But as a result, OCE made some investments in growing its service industries. While manufacturing opportunities have remained constant post-recession, the growth that OCE has experienced has been on our laundry and our contact centers, and I'll talk some more about them. Our work skills certification programs, we've had 71% of the inmates who begin the program do follow through to completion. The Work Skills Certification Program was established in 2005 as a 12-month industry-specific curriculum to complement the hands-on training that the inmates received while working in our industries. The program steadily grown and up to 2012 included a telecommunications certificate program. That program was suspended by the previous administration, however, we have made some pretty good efforts to get that back up and established, and actually working with some local contact centers to make sure that that is that the certificate that we create for that will allow them to go straight to work and meet their standards. And it's a pretty exciting new program or certificate program that we're creating. This is a list of our current work programs to show you. We have 6 contact centers and 454 inmates working in that. You can see from there the numbers of where those adults in custody are working. We have to maintain a variety of business lines to ensure agency continuity. Critical part of our structure is to ensure the programs are cost effective. And OCE retains diverse business lines and allows for the greatest work and training opportunities, as well as ensures OCE remains financially self-sustainable. We lose revenues in some of these training areas. However, they're very critical for people when they get out to have some success and some experience in those areas. So we have over 1,300 adults in our custody currently working in OCE programs. It's actually like 1,337 or 47 right now. And we have 27 separate businesses in 9 of our facilities. Our certification programs, our work skills certification classes are offered in 9 of the facilities that OCE operates from. The 12-month curriculum provide industry-specific training. Inmates receive a work skills certification upon successful completion, and the program provides industry transferable skills to the community. Our key goal is to work with those employers in the community so that they understand about our business and the type of work that the adults in custody are doing, so that they so there's value to that. And so that's been a huge part of what we've been doing with the Governor's Reentry Council, one of the work groups led by Mr. Dick Withnell, really getting out into the community and bringing those individuals to the table and learning about what we do. Most of them don't understand our capabilities, and when we tour them through our shops and through our service industries, they really, most of them, their jaw drops. They don't realize just how much is going on, but then they see value to what that employee may bring to the table. So the program participation eligibility criteria, They have to have at least 6 months clear conduct, and within 6 years of their release date. We're toying with that a little bit so we can meet more of their put more of them to work. We do have about 13% of our inmates, or about 176 of them, that are lifers. Doesn't mean they're doing forever, but they are lifers. We put those individuals in positions to where they are trainers and key positions so that they can help train more individuals as they go through their work. And then they have to possess a high school diploma or a GED that helps be in line with their institution programming requirements. And so we require all of that for them to be working in our shops. We're moving forward with providing bully industry recognized programs. That's so that it doesn't have a prison industry association with it. If it's a federally or a state recognized certificate, it's more meaningful to them. And it's not as embarrassing. So we have a program that we started in March of 15 under the structural welding offered through Cascade Joint Training Council. So it's been a very good program for the inmates to get involved in. So the effect on transition. So according to a 2016 DOC research report that I asked Paul Blatty from DOC to do for us, the OCE program effectiveness and identifying the best offenders for program. Our recidivism rate for the offenders who have spent at least 2 years of incarceration in a program within the last 2 years is 18.9% compared to 24.9% for the other all DOC releases. So in 2016, the director report published by National Correctional Industries Association reports a national average of 24.2% recidivism for offenders in correctional industries programs. We just came back from the National Correctional Industries Association conference in Pennsylvania. A lot of effort being done on reentry, a lot of good stuff going across the country, not just here in Oregon. There's that 24.2 compared to 40% across the state, so there's a lot of good happening there. One of the things that we don't know is why. And so we do need to do some more further analysis in there to suggest why, but nationally, we believe it's because of the improved likelihood of employment, a better wage within the institutions, the soft skills that are being developed in a working environment, and any other benefits working within OCE. One of the things that the employers in Oregon have been relaying to the work group led by Mr. Dick Withnell is they just want somebody to show up today, tomorrow, and they can train them. What we're finding, as the more we connect people to those employers in the community who are all starving for employees that will work, that it's a very good transition for them. We have people that are getting hired even by our own customers before they get out of prison, and most of them have been successful. Not all, but most. So and the fiscal data.
Can I interrupt you on that last point in terms of people being hired by your customers? So do you have information on how many people are actually finding employment within the areas that they were trained in under the Enterprise program?
No, we do not. One of the things that we're working with the employment department is having the individuals sign a release that allows us to track their Social Security number, their DOC, and they have been doing a really good job of, instead of just asking for that signature or that release at the beginning of their incarceration, they're doing it more towards the end so that those individuals know that that is more, it's a positive thing for them to do that so that we can track them and really focus on that. We are working with, and I'll cover here in a minute, but we're working with Econ Northwest. We hired them to do an impact analysis that OCE has on Oregon. And we're hoping that we can get enough information to start looking to see if it's industry specific. But that is almost a hand tracking thing for us to do, so it's difficult. So OCE's revenue and net income streams remain consistent with positive net incomes, and OCE continues to maintain self-sustainability. OCE has experienced 1 year. You'll notice in 2009 and 10 we had a negative net income. However, from the last 11 years we have not. This is a result of a substantial revenue decline in manufacturing operations due to the economic downturn in 2008. This year, our fiscal year, we are going to be pretty flat. We had a pretty good hit to our laundry and our contact centers. We've lost pretty significant revenue there, but we are already planning to bounce back. So with our constraints, I wish I would have been involved in this work group a little sooner, because I have several things I'd like to ask and at least support you all in. But we had one House Bill 3245 that was passed. OCE was missed in, it was originally, OCE's name was on it, but it somehow dropped off, so we'll be coming forward to get it put back on. But this is the statute 421, 423, the use of inmate labor for electrical and plumbing work. It says you can read what it says, but we will be coming forward in the 2017 session to ask to have OCE's name put back into that bill so that our licensed electrician can supervise the inmate electrician, so that we can further take care of our maintenance needs, so that we're not a burden on the Department of Corrections.
Can I have one thing on that, Ken?
Me?
So as part of that, we have a supervisee electrician that is an employee of Oregon Corrections Enterprises. So they both supervise inmates that already have electrical license and do the maintenance work, but we were also running inmates through an apprenticeship program. So they were going through a full electrician apprenticeship program, and they would leave with a license. That we had to suspend that program. So while not a significant number of inmates, those are those types of jobs that when you get out, there's availability, there's living wages, there's all of that. So again, a small number, but a pretty significant hit to those inmates that were in the program.
So you had to suspend that just because Corrections Enterprises wasn't listed?
Yes, sir. So we had a legal opinion that stated that OCE employees are not employees of the Department of Corrections, and so that was unfortunate. I don't think that's the way
it
was
interpreted. It came before my committee, and we were talking about OCE employees.
It was in an early draft in the bill, and then the final draft came out. And
okay. We haven't figured out how that happened either, but we're going to come forward trying to get that corrected.
Great.
I think it's already a legislative concept. Where'd she go? Yes. Okay. I talked about the Econ Northwest. They're going to give us that economic impact. I'll be happy to share that with you. And then one of the other constraints that we have is as we try to expand our programs, the DOC security staffing has always been a concern, is somehow trying to make that shift and create that burden onto the Department of Corrections has been problematic. So within our future, the new business opportunities, we've been really focused on. OCE is operating at a capacity in some operations, so our laundry operations at the penitentiary are at capacity. Over 270 inmates that are working in our laundries that are supporting our local hospitals. We have a new advisory council after I came on board almost 3 years ago now. And the new business strategy team was designed or developed afterwards, and the problems with the advisory board can be have a lot of good-hearted people, a lot of businessmen at a table, and it can get messy when they're involved in that. So what we did was we created a new business strategy team. So we invite these individuals from the community, these business owners into the community, to not just talk about how they can support OCE, but to learn how we can better support them. And that's through the jobs and the training that we provide these individuals. And it's really been a good educational component and something that we need to continue to try to build on. So we needed to expand our industry recognized certification training, so we have a focus on that so that we get more into the community to have them provide feedback on those training certificates so that it's more meaningful to them. And we are currently upgrading or rebuilding our website. So we needed to hire a technology and marketing specialist so that we can get our revenues and our manufacturing up to help be more sustainable. So you will see, if you've gone onto our website, you will see a new website here at the end of May that should be more user-friendly and really provide more information about the programming and the training opportunities that we're providing. And then, we will continue to participate in the Governor's Reentry Council. The specific one that I was talking about with Mr. Dick Withnell is the Business Implementation Team, which has been very enjoyable to be on. So that is a very quick presentation, so I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Some time ago, we met out, and I met and talked about linking what you do with what's needed, and meeting some of the prospective employers and seeing if some of the training that you can do inside. How is that? Are you still doing that? And how's that going?
Yes, that's the certification program. We're having a. And I'm hoping this is going to answer your question. So the certification programs, we are working directly with, like the communications one, to go to them. We develop what a certification would be, what trainings are needed for them, and then how do they demonstrate that skill. And so we are working with one of the local places that they will come through and look at everything and then make sure that it aligns with the skills that they need demonstrated. Did that answer your question? So we need, we have the BOLI certificate training for the welders. There's a huge need in welders. And there's several other certificates, the laundry certificates that all already are an industry standard.
How closely do you work with the employment division and looking at what their the needs are? And I raise this because not too long ago, because I also do Region Solutions, we were in Yamhill County with one of the employers, and his comment to us was that, I have the jobs, I just don't have the bodies. And, you're saying, hey, wait a minute, you've got the jobs and no bodies, so how are we, where is the Employment Division, where are you? And they manufacture, it's a manufacturing company that manufactures a particular part for Boeing. And he was very critical of, because we're all there saying what we want. And so it just came to my head, well, where is the Employment Division in all of this, and how do we align all this up if, because we're saying there's people who need jobs, we have bodies who need jobs, and I suspect that, they also do training themselves so that they can put them on a job. So how does all this collaboration fit?
We run a report from the Employment Division that tells us where the jobs currently are and where they suspect they'll be in 10 or 15 years, and we look at that. One of our biggest obstacles, well, there's two obstacles. One is there are people in the prison that do not want to work, and with OCE, we can't just give them an assignment and then force them to work. That's what the Department of Correction gets to do, but they have to want to work, they have to apply. We try to make it as realistic as possible. So it's really difficult to motivate people. When you talk to the employers in the community, they're having the same problem. So we have the same type of people that don't want to do manual labor. And so that's just been a struggle for us as well.
This wasn't manual labor. Welders are, I'm talking about skill sets now. I'm not talking about this or the $15 an hour jobs. And it just begged the question in my mind, what are we doing on this end to match up with the need over on this end? That's all I'm asking, and whether or not, you're having any contact with some of those employers. And I can see where this employer was having a problem, because who wants to live in this particular, and it's where with this little community and getting people to reside there.
Some of the jobs that we would like to create, or within OCE or even within DOC with some of them, it's really difficult to give them that experience when there's a displacement concern if we were to start something like that. So we may, I'll use pallets for an example, lots of pallet manufacturers, and they're coming to us to ask for help. And it's really difficult to do that when there's a displacement concern. We're waiting for the employment department to give us an analysis of that. So when it becomes a PI program, we do work directly with them, and they're processing that request from us now.
Yeah, and I realize that's a huge issue for you. You know, that I get. But in some respects, as policymakers, we're going to have to look at, on the one hand, we're asking or we're saying that we want individuals, when they come out, to be able to get to have a place to lay their head and to go get a job and what have you. And then there's all these other obstacles that are in the way that that the industry, they can't do. And I know when that piece of legislation won't measure that passed, you can't compete with private inside of the institution. So it's kind of like we built this little box and trying to figure out how to get out and punch our way out of the box.
Mark, correct?
Very well stated, I think. Yeah, no, that is something that we have to think about. The other challenge strikes me that we face is people may not be released into communities where there is this work, right? And there is that limitation I've come to be now sensitive to. And I don't know how we work our way around that, you know, or to what extent that becomes part of the, you know, the planning for the inmate about, you know, what program they might get into. You know, is it teaching them skills that they'll be able to use once they leave because there is that industry in the area that they're released to?
Good point.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask, are your staff, are OCE staff involved in kind of the transition planning for an inmate? I mean, if, say, they are trained in a skill where one county, like, that's, they're going to be employed once they release, but they're technically are being required to parole out into another county, is there any kind of, like, OCE stepping in and saying, hey, we would be willing to go to bat for this person to shift where they're going to release to, because it'd be a better situation for them in terms of recidivism or anything like that?
Yeah, that's just never been OCE's role. We do have some individuals that we will talk to their release counselors and those that need to help encourage some of that. There's a great relationship with the Department of Corrections there. Every individual's needs are different, and when we become aware of them, we do work with the Department of Corrections. We'll actually even work with them to transfer somebody so that they can get some of those skills. So that works really well, but it's just not our general part of our process.
That's awesome you're doing where you can.
Cindy.
So if I may just briefly interject, that information does become part of their work verification and is used in release planning, but as Senator Dimbrough mentioned, sometimes the county of release and where they're eligible to go to plays a part. So the person may have a job opportunity in another county, and we work with those counties, the county of record and the county that has the job opportunity, to determine if the person were to move to the county where the job opportunity exists, is that sufficient, and could he or she receive housing and other wraparound supports and supervision if we had a waiver in place for that to occur. Sometimes that can happen and sometimes it cannot, for lots of reasons. But it is an option that we look at. And anything from OCE work-wise is part of the release planning work verification, so that the parole officer has that information at release and can use it as part of the supervision plan as well.
Okay, why don't we move on? Ken, why don't you stay there, though, while Eddie, if you could just that we're kind of getting towards the end, but if you could get us started on the experience of in-house training programs and maybe, you know, how they interface or potentially.
Yeah, and they should interface, and that's one of the, I think, one of the shortfall that we have. I've had some conversation with OCE in the past about how do we credential some of the work that they do in OCE. And I don't think it's just about credentialing. It's making sure that it has some value other than, you know, call center, I'm going to give you a credit for a sales class, right? And if that sales class doesn't bring you someplace else to a business degree or someplace else you want to go, we're just doing a lot of paperwork. There's virtually no post-secondary opportunities inside the Oregon Correctional Facilities. There are a few. The Building Construction Program at SRCI. We have had the same challenges as Mr. Jeske as far as tracking those offenders once they release and virtually don't come back. But do they work? Your question earlier was, are they working in the building construction field? I couldn't answer that question. But they're not coming back, I think, which is part of the goal. There's some automotive things over here in Chemeketa, a little bit of vocational training. Sorry, I'm a little older, right? Used to be, now it's called career and technical ed, but we all know it as vocational training.
That's all right. I relate to vocational training.
at the Women's Center as well. And the feds have just opened up the Second Chance Pell Grant, and that's now Chemeketa and Portland Community College have received opportunity to do that. So the feds are seeing the opportunity to give college funding for incarcerated individuals. The challenge that I've seen over the time I've been here in Oregon is that when a gentleman releases or a woman releases, they instantly have this restitution bill. They have no deference. And we had some conversation, I believe, at the last meeting. If you're a community college student, when you get out, you have 6 months before you have to start to pay your bill. There's some expectation that you would get on your feet, get a job, move forward. And we don't do that to our offenders, which I think is probably a critical mistake. It does two things. One, it puts them in way behind the curve, just walking out the door, but it really prohibits them from going to school. You'll find most community corrections officers need them to go to work because they need to move forward. And so now you're going to have a group of offenders taking college classes inside your correctional facilities and won't be able to continue when they get out because you're going to have to go to work or have to continue at a different rate. And I don't know if that's, I don't know how you see that, but I see that as a challenge. You finally get somebody who's moving forward with their, where they want to go in their career and have to defer that. So I have some concerns about that. And then the other piece, I think, from the community college standpoint, should we need to come up with a way to make online classes accessible to incarcerated individuals. Mm-hmm. The current challenge that we have right now is all the online classes have links that allow access to other areas inside the internet, right? So you can lock an inmate down to a particular screen or whatever, but if they get in a college class, the resources send them out someplace else. And so those classes really need to be redeveloped so that those resources are live or PDFs or someplace where it stops the inmate from getting out onto the internet, which is one of the big concerns inside the Department of Corrections. But I don't think that's a heavy lift. I think that's a community college conversation more than a lot of extra work. Then it becomes accessibility inside the correctional institutions, but most correctional institutions have some computers that would allow inmates to get on a fixed screen and continue in their educational path. So, again, I think the biggest piece, as we've talked over the last couple of meetings, is a deferment of a restitution, and the same thing for Department of Motor Vehicle. You end up with this big DMV fine, so you can't get your driver's license. We continually talk about housing, but transportation and employment are right there. If you can't get a job and then you can't get to the job, those are things we have. I think you asked about legislative changes. Some kind of deferment would probably be, in my mind, probably paramount. And then if you got out and you went to school, then you would be deferred until you finished your educational career.
Do we know you know, on this challenge of online education, are there states that are finding ways around that are farther along than we are in this?
I think the juvenile facility has made bigger strides than the adult correctional facility, which I find interesting. They've internalized some intranet, for lack of better terms, classes.
Here in Oregon.
So here in Oregon, and go ahead.
Yeah, Frank Martin is who you're referring to at OYA. He's right. Done some remarkable things. He's actually working with one of the software giants. I don't remember which one it is, but I think it's called Rachel. Right. Has his little internal thing. So I know he's making some pretty good strides in that.
And Rachel is just basically, it imitates the internet, and you can control the content. So clearly there's
controlled content.
I'm sorry?
Rachel is a server with controlled content.
Correct. And there just needs to be some conversation with the community colleges to put that content on those devices, and literally you could be running live online classes inside every correctional facility.
I mean, it seems to me that every state is facing this challenge, and there should be some kind of technology that, you know, that would have some mass of interest.
Yeah. Yeah. Last week I met with some folks from the Idaho Department of Corrections, because of where I live, and also in the same situation that we are, and a little further along working on juveniles, because the juvenile inmates have had Pell for a long period of time, so they have funding. And so they came to us and said, how do we get classes in here? And so it's really a challenge, I think, across the country. And I think everybody's going to come up with a fairly quick resolve to that. The other piece I was talking about earlier is that last week I was going through some of the federal grants, and there's a number of federal grants, one in particular that is designed to do credentialing of correctional industries type of work for community colleges, which I, of course, caught my interest.
Oh, I'd love that. So I'd love to see that.
So there are some. There clearly, it's a national problem, and it's a national movement to try to figure out credentialing of inmates as they move out into the community to make sure they can get employment.
Great. Okay. Any questions for Eddie about you know, his side of things? Eddie, going back to your original observation that maybe there could be more connections between OCE and regular training, you want to talk more about that?
I've had a few conversations with Benny Ward and some of the folks that work for OCE, and said, how do we make this work? We do that now as a community college, so if you've been in a particular industry for an extended period of time, you can get credit for prior learning. You come in and I want to work on my business degree. Well, great, we're going to give you, what have you done, and do some type of portfolio and give you some credit heading towards your degree. We can do that inside the correctional facility. I think the challenge is they don't know where they're going, right? I don't know if I'm going to a business degree. I need a job. And so we can do it for the folks that want to move in that direction, but there's got to be some filtering, some process for them to self-identify, because it's pretty difficult to identify those individuals.
Yeah, you know, I know that we, a few years ago, charged the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission to, you know, really look at proficiency-based education and what we could be doing more of here in this state in terms of credentialing for experience, you know, using assessments that we can feel confident are, you know, are really showing what this person can do. And it seems to me that, you know, I'm not sure that we ever talked about the prison population, you know, as beneficiaries of this, but I think there's really a case to be made there. You know, your workers are getting really valuable experience that many of them probably could easily get some official certification as a result of the skills that they've developed. How can we make that happen?
We have some discussion. It's, Benny and I talked about it. It's ironic that we have a building construction program at Snake River. They're building similar things across the state. Our guys are able, with a one-year state certificate in building construction, can go on to PCC or OIT to finish their degrees, and their guys can leave with no credential at all. So
we've looked at several programs and that are through a community college. I think we've even talked to you about our CAD program, sharing that same space, doing the training and the actual work so they get the full experience. And for when it comes to the trade program up at Snake River, the only opportunity we have to make one of those programs self-sustaining so that we can continue it is if we are able to sell some of the products that they're making to keep it going. And then the first roadblock that we come to is not enough revenue or it's displacement. And that's always becomes our first unfortunate roadblock.
I think some of the challenges have been we're an educational piece, right? So we're not really out to make a profit, and they need to make a profit to stay alive. And so it's a different mentality, although we're teaching the same skills.
Seems like a really ripe arena for a partnership, you know, especially with the Pell Grant money that is available now. And, you know, certainly your workers, you're involved in a profit-making enterprise. But, you know, in the same way that apprentices who are working, you know, out in the field, they're involved in a profit-making enterprise, but they're still getting certification out of it. I don't know. I think that's something for us to think more about.
We have some of our programs that don't generate any, like if you look at the women who are hugely underserved right now. We provide them a CAD class and a textiles class with no revenue generation whatsoever. So some of the revenues we make over here we use to support just what you're suggesting. We're always looking for more, especially with the women.
All right, well, thank you. Thanks for coming, Ken. And we'd love to have you stay engaged with this. Right. Okay, so our next meeting is scheduled for May 26th, the last Thursday of May. It so happens that that's also the week that the legislature comes to Salem for our legislative week. And the our committee hearings are Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Thursday is a time where task forces are meeting. And so we may have some competition for that time. So normally we meet 1 to 3. We may have to ask you to be flexible with the time on that day. But yes,
Mr. Chair, task force members, we are we have 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. reserved on the 26th currently. If that needs to change, we can, but probably not within that day.
Okay. So at this point, 2 to 4 is what we're looking at. Okay. Great. Hopefully, as many of you can make it as possible. Andrea?
It will be in this room, yes.
Okay, great. One last thing before we adjourn. Zoe, we had talked about trying to do some outreach to families of incarcerated individuals, try to get them involved in this process as well. So can you tell us what has happened so far, and perhaps, you know, we have people here in the room maybe that can help make those contacts.
I did a little bit of outreach. Jeremy and I actually had an opportunity to speak before the meeting, and it sounds like we may have some ideas that we can talk about offline in terms of getting people here. But I know that you all have networks, and it would be great to have people who have either experienced incarceration or family members in particular. We'd love to have them join us.
Yeah, I think I've got some people that are comfortable in speaking roles and would like to share their stories. Family members will reach out and see. Transportation, I mean, most of the people we know are in the Portland metro area, so if you don't mind carpooling, if anyone's traveling down, we can maybe work something out. So
I think that would be great. And I don't know if there, if you know of anyone.
Bring it back to our group. And
great.
And see if there, what, do you have any dates in mind, or?
Our next meeting, if possible.
Okay, well, again, thank you, guests and presenters. We really appreciated your input. And again, always focus on the legislation. Be thinking, you know, any ideas that you have, please do pass them along. All right, thank you. So with that, we are adjourned. So with that, we are adjourned.